Welcome to the Wellbeing Rebellion, the podcast that's changing workplace cultures for good. We're your hosts, Ngazi Weller
and Obehi Alafoje.
Let's get this rebellion started. This week on the Wellbeing Rebellion, I am speaking to Amanda Bennett. Amanda has a long history of working in culture change environments, firstly with children and young people, and more recently at Guide Dogs. She is currently head of DEI for Guide Dogs for the Blind, and she's passionate about creating inclusive and accessible environments for everyone, and has driven the agenda at Guide Dogs for more than 4 years. In her spare time, she likes running, walking, and lives with her three dogs, including one retired guide dog. Amanda is someone that I am hugely impressed by. She's someone who I believe has the heart of a rebel with a good cause. And I can't wait for you to hear her thoughts on the topics of disability, DEI, and how we can make the world more diverse and inclusive for the benefit of everyone. Let's dive in. Amanda, welcome to the Wellbeing Rebellion, and thank you so much for joining us and for being patient with all the technical issues we've just had. Sorry about that.
Great to be here. I'm glad to be here with you.
And it's exciting because it's International Women's Week, I think it is, but we're celebrating it as a month. Why not? Why not have a year at the Wellbeing Rebellion?
Should be every day.
This is an interview that I've been the most nervous and the most excited about, really. I'll tell you why I've been nervous is because I've met you before.
You have?
I think you're the perfect person to talk to about the topic of disability. And I feel like I'd be safe with you showing my sheer ignorance on this topic. So I'm a little nervous because I'm going to, if it's okay with you, ask you the questions that I know many people are thinking and just might not have anyone that they could ask about them.
Yeah, absolutely. No such thing as a silly question. If it comes with good intent, it's not a silly question. If it comes with ill intent or with intentions to be disrespectful of me or to be ableist, then that's not good. But I know you well enough to know that that's not the intent. So we'll be good. Ask whatever you want and I'll do my best to answer it because we have worked before together and it was a brilliant day. Loved it. So ask away and I'll do my best to help.
Good. Okay. Well, let me start with my first question. And I've never met somebody who I could ask this to. There's so much debate in the wider world in our society about ableism. And I'm the mum of a 14-year-old daughter who is as right on, and I'm so proud of her, but she is very, very careful about not offending people, and that's right, that I know there's a lot of furore about this, so I never know what's the right words to use. I know I talk about it all the time. I'm neurodiverse and so is most of my family. And we in that community, some people call it a disability, some people call it a different ability. And there seems to be battle lines drawn. But when you talk about traditional differences, such as your sight loss or hearing loss, OB has hearing loss. Is that disability strictly, or do you prefer the term different ability? So when should I say disability? When should I say different ability?
So I think it's really interesting to draw the distinction between disability and neurodiversity, because you're quite right. There's a big furore about, and there has been over a number of years, about whether neurodiversity is a disability or it's not. My view and the view that we have at Guide Dogs is that neurodiversity is not a disability unless someone says my neurodiversity has so many disabling factors that I consider myself to be disabled. In that situation, then it absolutely is. But for lots of people, neurodiversity gives them creativity, it gives them diversity of thought, it gives them a whole world of different skills which are really valuable in the context of a team. So to have a team with somebody who's neurodivergent in it is it brings a whole different set of skills and a different way of thinking that you might have if it's a group of people working on a problem who are all neurotypical. And diversity of thought is really important in organisations in order to be able to drive activity or drive change or drive an agenda. Disability in terms of my vision impairment or someone's hearing loss or a lifelong health condition, I think that there is often a hesitancy to call it disability these days. And quite often, if you're on LinkedIn, you see people putting pictures up of these absolutely terrible toilet signs where they've tried to think of something other than disabled toilet. And you're just like, really? My view is that it's fine to say disabled. That's okay. There's no issue with that. I personally, and everybody has their own views, and it's not for me to tell someone else with their own lived experience how they should self-identify. But for me, less abled grates on me far more, because I'm like, are you serious? Because I'm plenty abled. I might not see very well, but I'm able. Don't you worry about that. So I think disabled for me, it's very clear for people to understand. They know what it means, and I'm fine with that as an identification for me. But again, it's a really personal thing. And what I always say is, if you're in a conversation like we are now with someone that you get to know and they refer to themselves in a different way, then try to mirror their language in terms of their identification of themselves, because everyone will be different.
That's the principle I go by. I simplify it a little bit and I just say, it's called don't be a dick. So
all that.
Well, it's true. If someone, you meet someone and you think, oh, that's a woman, and then you speak with them and they refer to themselves as they, them, why continue to force her and she? Similarly, if you think, okay, I'm meeting this person and they're disabled, but they refer to themselves as differently abled, then why would you force it? Okay, so asking the question isn't offensive, so long as you do so with good intent and listen to the answer and act on it.
Pretty much. Okay. There's nothing worse than asking the question and then not listening to the answer.
Totally ignoring it. Yeah, going away. All right. So can you tell, for I know you, but for the benefit of the listeners out there, can you tell us a little bit about your journey? So you're the DEI lead at Guide Dogs for the Blind. But you've got an extraordinary personal journey as well. I don't really want to get in the way. I just want you to tell your story.
Yeah. Okay. So, I'm the head of diversity, equity and inclusion at Guide Dogs. I've been in this role for 4.5 years. Prior to that, this is my third national charity. I'm pretty much a charity bunny. I've never worked in the private sector. Prior to that, I was in children and young people's services, so with a number of different children's charities. So when I arrived at Guide Dogs, I'd had some surgery on my eyes, but I still had really good vision. I was still driving. I was still able to see as well as anybody else. And that was just corrective vision through surgery. And then in 2022, I banged my head very hard. I cracked into something and knocked myself out. And then as a result of that, I had a detachment in each eye. And then when they were repaired, they left me with some residual challenges around the clarity of my vision, but also how much I can see at any one time. So I have two competing issues going on at the same time. So one's about my actual eyes, but the other's about my brain's ability to interpret what my eyes see. So the two things together limit my sight somewhat. I have no depth perception at all. but I do have reasonable visual acuity most days. So it can be very variable. So some days I'll be, so that conference we went to, Ngozi, in Manchester, I went in the lift with my colleague and I was like, oh, there's a fox crossing the road. She's like, how do you see that? And then an hour later, I couldn't find my way out the room we were in because the light was different and my brain was more tired, and I struggled with that. So it can be really variable. And I think that's the other thing I would say is that quite often with any kind of impairment or disability, it can be quite variable. So that could be about what you can see or what you can hear, but it could also just be about what your coping skills are or what your resilience is on that particular day. So it's good to work with people where they're at on that day and not be, particularly in my case, saying, what do you mean you can't see it? You can see it yesterday, because that's just the way it is, that it's a, you know, it's a spectrum. It's not something that's static, and it is how it is every day. Certainly not for me. It can be different every day. So currently at Guide Dogs, I lead the diversity, equity and inclusion agenda, and that includes ensuring that Guide Dogs is geared up to be a gold standard employer for people who are vision impaired as well. I should add, Ngozi, that I actually chair the Access to Work Forum on behalf of DWP as well. So that's, again, a really important role in terms of driving forward the relationship between employers and government in relation to the Access to Work programme, which is a grant-funded programme that helps people to fund reasonable adjustments in work.
So you are the perfect person to speak to about this topic of disability, because you've got the lived experience and then the career and professional experience. But it's you, if I get it right, you had very good vision when you went to work for Guide Dogs for the Blind. So it wasn't because you were visually impaired that you went to work for them. It's just a coincidence.
Yeah, absolutely, it is. So no one, I'd had surgery on my eyes, but I certainly wasn't vision impaired. And I went to work at Guide Dogs because pretty much I'd had an ambition to go to Guide Dogs as a charity for pretty much my entire career. And so then when a role came up that was suited to me and my skills and experience, and it was in the area I am, then I applied for it straight away and got it. And it really was my dream to work at Guide Dogs, really, for everything that it does. Besides being an employee here, I'm an avid fundraiser, I'm a volunteer, and a firm advocate for Guide Dogs as well.
So we were talking earlier about disability and DEI, and I mean, the question that just popped into my mind was, why did you go into diversity, equity and inclusion for your career in the first place? Did it have to do with any disability experience that you'd had in your family or growing up? Was there a reason you were attracted to that profession?
Yeah, so prior to taking on this DEI role, which was coming up for 5 years ago, I'd always been in roles that were driven around culture change and also around fairness and equity. So I suppose I was in the fairness, equity and inclusion sphere of the work long before I came into like a full DEI role. And that was because I think my mum would say, if she was here, that from being a really small child, I was always the one that was a champion for other people, or a champion for the person that couldn't be heard at school. Or, you know, she would be called in to say, oh, Amanda's been in to see the head teacher because she doesn't think such a body's been treated fairly and we need to stop her doing this. Yeah. My mum was like, no, we don't. It's fine. This is who she is. So I don't think it came as a surprise to anyone when I moved into this field of work. I think my entire family were like, yeah, that's the right job for her. But what drove me, I think, to move into it like fully in the end when I came into this role, was that whilst at the beginning and even at the start of this job I didn't have the vision impairment, I did know what it was like to be in a position where I was disadvantaged. So if we think about the wheel of privilege, I was female, I came from divorced parents. My mum was on her own bringing us up and she wasn't well. I was a young carer, which meant I didn't go to university. And so I left school with GCSEs and went straight to work so that I could support her, because I couldn't leave her and my young sister at home and go away to uni. So I knew what it was like to constantly, and my whole career, aside from of any vision issue, my whole career has been about fighting against the, but you don't have a degree. Well, no, but I have 30 mm-hmm. years of experience. Yeah, but you haven't got a degree. And so I've always faced that level of there being multiple barriers to climb over. And that just made me, when this role came up, think, but I can use my passion, my courage, if I'm honest, and my voice to go and do something about this and improve this for not only for employed populations now, but also for children and young people who are the employees of the future, to make sure that they don't have the barriers when they come through that people are seeing now. And that's what drives me every day, really.
Mm. And we were talking about how that diversity, equity, inclusion has really it's had its moment in the spotlight as a result of George Floyd's murder and Black Lives Matter. DEI became a global phenomenon, but the spotlight shifted so far away from disability. It was about, and I'm not saying this is wrong, because everybody knows I'm an advocate for inclusion for everybody, but the spotlight was very much on race. It's pretty much, I think, been on gender for since the beginning of the DEI in the workplace movement. But we moved away from where, when I started out my career, when we were talking about DEI, we were talking either about gender equality and women's rights and how to make the workplace inclusive for people with a physical disability. And we don't talk about that as much anymore. It's like, yeah, we've done it. All those workplace adjustments have been done, and it's time to move on. But is that your experience?
So I think there's an element of truth in that. And I think we, you know, of course, when George Floyd was murdered, there was an absolute outcry for what happened, and rightly so. And we do absolutely need to be focused on doing more around race and ethnicity and minoritized ethnic communities. I think we need to, and we shouldn't lose track of that at all, but we do need to also be working on all those other groups, so the LGBTQI plus community, who are, you know, often, mm-hmm. You know, there's been some really high profile cases recently of how horrendously treated, you know, members of that community can be, both in work and out in the community more generally, in their homes and in their communities. And I think that's also, you know, we shouldn't lose sight of it for disability either. I mean, there's still only 1 in 4 people who are registered either blind or severely sight impaired who are currently in work. So that's 25% of the VI population are in a job. And there are some phenomenally talented and capable people. And that figure hasn't changed in a generation. That figure is fairly static for many, many years and decades. And we need to do more to improve that. So I think the concern for me, if I was to have one, is that in 2020, charities and private sector businesses really put a big push on DEI because they recognised that they weren't doing enough and they needed to do more. And they realised that it was no longer good enough to be a passive bystander and you needed to step up and deliver. My concern now would be that as they're faced with multiple other challenges, including financial challenges, the cost of living is meaning that less people are donating to charities, and that there's, you know, they're having to make tougher decisions, that becomes a nice to have rather than an essential. And it's really important that DEI is embedded into the absolute foundations of an organisation, because it isn't something you can do and then it's done and we can all go off and focus on something else. Because of the human factors involved, we need to be constantly there and constantly reinforcing it and upskilling and educating and raising awareness so that we can make sure that these are sustainable changes into the long haul. And I think, well, like 3 years, just over 3 years post George Floyd, coming up to 4 years later this year. And I think the danger would be that organisations start to think that the job's now done, and it absolutely isn't.
It's not even anywhere close, to be fair.
It's just started, isn't it? Really, is the truth of it. It isn't anywhere near done.
It's not what, and unfortunately, we've already seen in the press companies backpedaling and starting to slash investments, get rid of full-time DEI roles that were put in place in 2020, 2021. They're starting to shift focus and shift critically resource. So so if you're talking to heads of businesses who are saying, yeah, we have got multiple pressures, lots of priorities, why should DEI be one for them?
It's a no-brainer, isn't it? And I know I'm like preaching to the converted and talking to you, but it's a no-brainer, because a diverse, engaged, supported, included workforce produces diversity of thought, better problem solving, then there's less turnover, people are more productive because they feel like they belong and they feel invested in the organization. There's just 101 reasons, not to mention the fact that there's a legal risk if you mess it up. So there's a whole host of reasons why this is a good thing to have. And what would disappoint me now is if we get to a place where we start to do exactly what you've just described and be like, yeah, we can't afford it anymore. We're 4 years in. You know, and what I would say to those leaders is go back and think about, what did you say in the weeks and months after George Floyd died? What were your commitments to those communities then? And actually, are you telling me that, you know, after all these years of people being oppressed and being discriminated against and not having fair treatment either in their communities or in their workplace, that we've fixed all that in 4 years? You know, we just haven't. So go back, look back in your own self and in your own, you know, in your own life and your professional life, and think about, what commitments did I make then? And can I honestly say that those commitments are fulfilled? And if they're not, then you need to just press on forward. And, you know, it's a no-brainer for me, because it saves money in the long term. If we think about what the cost of a high turnover of employees is, it's huge, isn't it? By the time somebody's left, and then if they've gone, and they've gone because they weren't happy or they didn't feel like they belong, the reputational damage that causes when they take to Glassdoor and tell everybody how unhappy they were, or, you know, even just when they're talking among their peers, and then the recruitment costs and the costs of onboarding and the time it takes to get that next person up to speed. By having a DEI team there that can make sure that that's smoother and you don't have that level of churn and turnover, it pays for itself, really, in more than, doesn't it? You know, so for me, I would say, think about that, and think about also, what kind of organization do you want to be? Do you want to be an organization that isn't committed to this stuff? Because really, a lot of it is fairly basic, fundamental, you know, good human behavior. And do you not want to be driving that forward and reinforcing that in your organization? That's not a place I'd want to be.
So in terms of DEI and its focus, particularly with disability, so physical disability, because I know neuro inclusion has become, it's the topic du jour, the flavor of the month, and that seems to be where everybody's disability focus is. And like you, I'm not sure it's not the same thing. I know it's not the same thing. It requires significant consideration. It is important, but it's different. So how can we ensure inclusivity and accessibility in the workplace for people who have physical disabilities? So that one in four becomes one in three, one in two.
Yeah, so I think you're right, it's not the same, but it's equally important, isn't it? We shouldn't ever be pitching characteristics off against each other, or the experience off against each other. And, you know, you do get people who are vision impaired and neurodiverse, or people
do you?
Who are, yes, seriously.
Definitely not.
Or people who are vision impaired and from you know, an LGBTQI plus background or whatever intersectional
and
characteristics.
Black as well.
There,
and no,
I know. Yeah, it's like it's a real thing, intersectionality. So it's really important that you get it right, isn't it? And I think when organisations are looking at supporting people who have got a disability, then the things they need to consider are, what does the Equality Act tell you you need to do? So what it tells you is that you need to treat that person fairly and equitably, and they mustn't be disadvantaged because of their disability. So that doesn't mean that we just say, oh, well, they were a really good candidate, they gave a really good interview, but they're going to be really hard work because we're going to need to adapt our premises, or we're going to need to get them a different laptop, or we're going to need to change the lighting in the room they're going to work in, or we might need to, you know, get closed captions turned on onto our teams, or have an a BSL interpreter in the space. Well, you'll have to get on with it, I'm afraid, because that's life, and that's what we need people to do. But in return for that, what you get are these amazing, creative, capable individuals in role who you might otherwise miss out on. So I would say think about that, because the community of employees I see at Guide Dogs who are vision impaired are some of the best problem solvers I've ever come across. They're the most resilient and capable individuals, and they're also really good professionals. But I know myself, just to live your life day to day with a vision impairment, you need to be a good problem solver, because you need to think about, how am I going to find out what platform my train's going on for me, because I can't read the sign that tells me what platform it's going on. And if you've been to London Euston recently, you'll know that there's nobody to ask. So how am I going to do that? So through to, how am I going to find my seat on the train, because I can't read the numbers over the seat. So how am I going to work that out? And through to, you know, I've got colleagues who perhaps have less vision than me. How am I making sure that I've got two black shoes on in a day and I haven't got a blue one and a black one on? Whatever it might be, these are all problem solving skills that are transferable into a workplace. So I would say we need to be more open-minded and encourage people to be looking at the Disability Confidence Scheme, because there's lots of information and tools on there to support you to be a good employer. There's access to work to support you with the costs. So the law requires that as an employer, you pay for everything that is reasonable. But wherever there are adaptations or costs that are above and beyond what is reasonable, then there is support for that through the government's Access to Work scheme. And that's available to all employees with a disability. So I would just be saying, it's the right thing to do, and it's the business savvy thing to do, because there are a whole load of skills out there that you're depriving yourself of if you just have this view that it's going to be a load of aggro rather than focusing on what are the positives and the benefits.
We touched briefly, tongue in cheek, on intersectionality, and it is International Women's Week, mm-hmm. or month, or year, or decade. Is there a point in which sexism in the workplace meets with ableism and forms a very unattractive love child that makes it harder for women with disabilities to access the support that they need to be in the workplace?
Yeah, I would think quite probably. So that isn't my experience of being at Guide Dogs, but I recognise that I'm in quite a charmed and privileged position because I'm in a charity that knows about vision impairment, and that's our day job. But what I would do is take us back again to that wheel of privilege and how much your kind of voice and your opportunity and your ability to influence is diminished with every thing that's piled on top of your lived experience. So, you know, we all know, anybody listening to this who is female will know that it is not yet an equitable world. If you're female, it might be much better than it was, but there are still plenty of ways where we have to work harder, faster and better to be seen in a similar light to a man of a comparable level in a role. So that's life. We know that. It's the same if we go to buy a car. I went, before I had my vision impairment, I went to buy a motorbike with my ex-husband, and I was buying the bike. I was a really keen biker before my trouble with my eyes, and we went into the showroom and the guy goes, so sir, can I let me tell you all about the bike? And he goes on, and Steve, my ex-husband, let him talk for ages about this bike, and then he went, that's all very interesting, but you might want to tell her, she's the one buying. And the bloke was like, right. And it blew this man's mind that I might be the one stood there considering buying a bike. So those kinds of things are just commonplace in the life of being a woman, aren't they? And then you add on to that any other kind of intersectional characteristic, and you just add on more and more barriers, more and more challenges that you've got to overcome. And I think that I haven't experienced that at Guide Dogs, certainly, but I do experience it just day to day in my life, that, you know, you see that, and the reaction of people towards you because you're female is very different to what it might be to your male peer. And I think that's just part of the life we live, but it, as a woman, but it's amplified if you've got a disability or you've any other characteristic that adds to that level of complexity for people to just almost like process in their heads. So they're like, you know, what you mean she's a woman and she's struggling to see? Oh my goodness. Let me help her to this chair and sit her down quick.
You're a damsel in distress, you know it.
Yeah, that's it, I think. And you know, I mean, I was just about to say, and the number of times you get crossed over the road when you don't want to go, but I think my male colleagues, if they were sat here, would say that happens to us too. No, it does. Yeah, where people just grab hold of you on a crossing and you're on the other side of the road before you know what's happened. Yeah, but I think my male colleagues would say, yeah, that happens to us too. So that's not because you're female.
Would you ever just assume that's what the person, why?
Yeah. Yeah, well, people do, and they're trying to be kind, so then you need to be charitable around that. So, yeah,
well, yeah, to a certain extent, but it does annoy me because I just think you could try to be kind. Is, excuse me, were you trying to cross the road? Can I help you?
Yeah,
not come on, then, love, I've got you. Don't worry, don't you worry, I'm gonna cross. That's the bit that there's a degree of arrogance. Mm-hmm. And that's not caring anyway, but
we digress
a little bit. What I wanted to know was if I'm in a position of responsibility where I can do something to influence the workplace to make it more inclusive for people of any minoritized capacity, so whether it's, you know, because they've got a disability, whether it be visual impairment or because they've got neurodivergent, whatever it is, if I'm in that role, what should I be doing?
So for me, you should be constantly checking your unconscious bias, because I see that a lot, and the problem with unconscious bias is you're not always aware of it. So I think that some of the ways that I encourage people to address that at Guide Dogs is to be having regular conversations with us, that we hold monthly calls, which are just like a drop-in session for managers to pop in and chat to us if they want to. So if they've got a situation where they're not sure what they're going to do, or they're about to have a difficult conversation and they're worried because they don't know how to word it, or like you were earlier, they don't know how to refer to disability or whatever, then they can come and chat to us in a safe space and we'll provide them with some support or give them the opportunity to role play their conversation or whatever before they go off and do it. And that's a good thing, because it allows that person to go off and be and do less harm and disadvantage to that person because they've prepared in advance than they might if they clumsily go barreling in and say something that hurts or causes offence to the person that they're trying to have the conversation with. So I would always say, check your own unconscious bias, because that's really important. Remember that you're not comparing. If you're comparing people with each other, you're not comparing apples with apples, you're comparing apples with pears, because everybody's an individual and everybody's going to have different lived experience, a different map of the world, and different ways of tackling different situations. So you need to be person-centered in the way that you deal with each and every person, you know, because if somebody were to compare me to you, we're very much aligned in our values, but we're very different in the way that we present and the way that we do our job. So therefore we should be objective in the way that we're assessing people's competency, and we shouldn't be comparing one person with another, because lived experience is always going to be very different. And then the other thing, if you're in a leadership role, that I am really, really passionate about, is we shouldn't just be talking, when we're talking about manager competence, we shouldn't just be talking about behaviour, we should be talking about values, because anybody can put some behaviours on, but your values come from within your soul and they're inherently within you. And if your values are not based in being fair and equitable and tackling your own unconscious bias and being really conscious about how you support other people and facilitate them to be the best that they can be and to thrive in their role, then you're not going to sustain it. If that's just something you've read in a book before you've gone for an interview, you might be able to talk a good game to get through your interview, but you're not then going to sustain it. So at the point that you're recruiting managers, we need to be talking about values. What are your values? What drives you to support people? How do you do that? How do you make sure that's fair and equitable for everyone? And they're the things that I'm really passionate about as taking forward, because otherwise, what you see is pockets of people who can deliver a stunning interview, but then cause real harm and disadvantage and hurt to members of their team who might have those characteristics.
I love that answer. That was perfect. And it's a great segue to the final question that I have for you. Okay. I can tell that you are a lady with the heart of a rebel. You are a true well-being rebel. So as such, what change would you like to see in the future that would make well-being for people with disabilities something that is achievable in the workplace?
So I think there's a few things. I think that there needs to be some changes from a more kind of policy level around the Equality Act. I don't think it's strong enough, and I think it allows too much room for manoeuvre. It's good to have something that's broad enough that you can account for lots of different situations, but I think it creates too much wriggle room for those who are intent on not doing the right thing. So I'd like to see that tightened up. But then I'd like to see employers understand that everyone isn't the same, and whether it be that, you know, if we think about the different kinds of lived experience people can have, the nine protected characteristics are just a start, aren't they? You know, even if it's about being you know, just your lived experience in your childhood or moving into your education or your mental health or whatever it might be, everybody's story is different. And I would like to see us get to a place where we're much more asset based. So we're looking at what people are good at and what skills people bring and what are their qualities that they bring, rather than looking at what are the things that might be a challenge or a barrier, because we should be working with people to help them overcome those things. So what do people bring? And to celebrate, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but to celebrate that diversity of thought, because it makes such a huge difference to an organization. If everybody's thinking one dimensionally, you get a one dimensional solution, don't you? If you bring in lots of people together, and some of the best meetings I've ever been in are where you get loads of people with different lived experience and different perspectives who've maybe come from roles in different sectors beforehand, and they all bring something different to the table, and that richness that comes from that gets you to a much better place than a group of people who've got similar lived experience, similar backgrounds, who all turn up thinking in the same way, and the solution is just so much better if you come from that more diverse group. And ultimately, whether you're in the private sector, the charity sector or local government, we've all got some kind of customers, and our employee base should reflect the communities we seek to serve, whether that's communities of people in geographical communities or communities of interest like a charity, or whether it be about your customers and your community of commercial customers. We've all got somebody that we're trying to relate to, and that's easier to do if your employee base or your volunteer base reflects those communities that you're trying to reach out to.
Such a wonderfully comprehensive and, I like to think, delightfully positive, not cliched response. I'd like to live in that rich rainbow tapestry of a world. And I'd like to work in that kind of office where diversity of thought, true diversity of thought, not diversity of thought of people who all have very similar experiences, but one happens to be a vegetarian. Not that kind of diversity.
No,
Right. Where true diversity is celebrated, a cause for success and not for conflict. I can't wait till we have a world which is more like that.
Me too. And I think, you know, it is right that it's a heady ambition I've got there. But if people aren't striving for it, we'll never get to it, will we? So
exactly.
I think it's perfect. I'll continue to strive for it. Yeah.
You do that, and I'll continue to support you along the way. Amanda, thank you so, so much for your time, your patience, and your openness with us today. I know the fellow rebels have loved hearing everything that you've had to share.
Cool. Thanks, Nicosia. Always lovely to see you.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Wellbeing Rebellion.
If you liked what you just heard, please share it with your colleagues, follow us on LinkedIn, the link will be in the show notes, and generally show us some love.
We want to build a whole army of fellow rebels who want to create positive workplaces for everyone. Will you join the rebellion? See you next time.